Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, 2:30 till 4 o'clock. This is the place every week where Christians and non-Christians get together for discussion and debate as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. Later on the show, we'll be hearing lots of your feedback, and we've had a real bumper mailbag of feedback this week to the last couple of weeks of programming. Not to forget that after today's show, you can hear The Profile. Today, Dave Rowe speaks to stand-up comedian Paul Carenza. Really interesting and fun discussion actually between them, so listen out for that between 4 and 5 on The Profile. For the moment, time to get into the show that aims to get you thinking.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, we're asking, can we build a godless, flourishing society? Discussing the question today are Alex Gabriel and Richard Park. Well, Alex runs the free thought blog Godlessness in Theory. He's especially interested in documenting LGBT issues there. But he was raised in a church-going home before he left the faith as a teenager. He now calls himself an apostate. Perhaps we'll have a chat about that later on. Christian apologist Richard Park, known to most people though as Rich, is part of the team at apologetics.com. Currently works in the Biblical and Theological Studies Department at Biola University. And Rich and Alex actually became friends at Oxford University. So we're having something like the kind of discussions and debates you regularly had over a pint of beer, but minus the beer, here in the studio.
Well, we had them over his pint.
Okay, because you interestingly, in this Christian atheist setup, you were the non-drinker, Alex.
I'm about as far from a sort of hedonist rock and roll atheist as you can be. Yeah. Sorry.
Whereas you're very much the hedonist Christian, aren't you, Rich?
That's right.
Rock and roll Christian all the way.
Yes. And to be fair, it wasn't just an atheist Christian thing. It was sort of an interfaith thing. But I appreciated Alex being one of the most faithful members of that group.
Tell us about this group then. What drew you together to have these interfaith discussions? Do you want to start, Rich?
Sure, yeah. So we... a couple of colleagues of mine and I were just thinking about the fact that at the University of Oxford, we had a ton of different student groups, many of which were sort of for and run by Christians or Hindus or Jews and Muslims, but very little cross-dialogue, if you will. And so as a result of that, we thought, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we had something somewhere right in the city center at a cafe or at a pub, where we can meet with one another on a regular sort of weekly basis. And so we reached out to a few folks, and Alex was certainly one of them. And because at that time, Alex, I think you were the president of the Atheist Unit Society.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Is that being the atheist equivalent of the Christian Union at Oxford?
Oh, I don't know. We don't have that much money, frankly. we don't have people like churches behind us. Something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Carry on there, Rich.
Yeah, we sort of met on a weekly basis, and more than anything, like I said, I think Alex, among a few others, were quite the regular members, and so and sometimes more regular than myself or others who helped start the group. And so we really kind of formed a nice friendship over the years, and since then have kept in touch. So I'm glad we were able to have a conversation like this now over the phone or over the studio radio.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Tell us again, you've come on the show a few years ago now, Alex, but you were raised in a church going home.
Yeah.
But sort of abandoned that faith in your teens. Sure. Were you influenced by atheists like Dawkins and others?
I'm fairly sure he has me blocked on Twitter now, or something like that.
You've fallen out since then.
Well, that's a whole other
podcast.
We won't go there. But I'd left the church a while before I started calling myself an atheist, and certainly, you know, the explosion of the new atheism 10 years ago was, I think, that catalyzed a lot of people and made them feel better about calling themselves atheists, especially people like me who'd been in religious homes and had to navigate that.
You came out, interestingly, with an interesting blog a few years ago, while still a student, I think, at Oxford, where you described being an atheist at Soul Survivor, which, for those who aren't aware, is a fairly significant Christian youth festival here in the UK, which I think, you know, got a lot of interesting response, because I think Christians like to hear about how their events sometimes seem to what you might call the outsider, though in a sense you were the insider.
The lion in a den of Daniels.
Yeah. In a sense. But you've called yourself an apostate as well, which is an unusual phrase to use. Do you really think you're an apostate?
Well, I mean, you mentioned earlier, it's a word that tends to be associated with people who are ex-Muslims or who've come from backgrounds like that. But, you know, a lot of the work that people in that blogging community do is about helping people leave religious environments and negotiate that. And so the word apostate has become a kind of useful label for people who write about those issues in other religions as well.
Sure. Well, it's great to have you on today. And
of course.
We look forward to a lively discussion between you both on the subject that we're digging into today. Godlessness in theory, does that kind of mean you're trying to work out what it means to be godless in today's
It probably
society.
Means godlessness in practice, yeah. No, I mean, it's a lot of things. It's partly having a more kind of humanities and social sciences approach to discussions around religion and coming from a more sort of anthropology point of view as opposed to sort of science as this. But it's also wanting to locate the issues around leaving religion and finding new sort of social communities and ways to live your life. And have those discussions about atheism in the way that you might talk about, you know, issues like gender or, you know, economics.
Would you say you're part of the quote-unquote atheist community?
You'd have to ask them, and you might get a loud response that lasted for several hours. I'm certainly
part
of... You
sound like you've kind of upset some people by the things you're saying here.
Oh, and long may it remain so. You know, if you're not upsetting someone, you're doing it wrong. But I'm certainly part of an atheist community.
Okay, yes. Tell us a little bit about apologetics.com, because that's the hat you come wearing today to the show, Rich.
Sure, yeah. So apologetics.com, believe it or not, started as a school project of a master's program in Biola by Harry Edwards, our mutual friend. Harry decided to take a school project and put it online and make it real other than just for a grade. And so he started this organization, which has sort of three prongs to it. One, which is speaking engagements, and then online engagement, and then a radio show, much like this, which takes place on a weekly basis. So that's what the organization is. It's meant to serve both the church as well as sort of to equip them with you know, thinking through their faith, but also to challenge non-Christians to take more seriously the issues of faith in public life.
The strap line is something like, isn't it, challenging believers to think and thinkers to believe? Is that the...
Yeah, that's right. Although, to be fair, I have a little bit of a quibble with that, because it you know, seems to be a mutually exclusive sort of thing, and only people who really think are non-believers.
Nevertheless, it's a nice play on words.
Yeah, yeah.
But in any case, thank you very much for joining me on the program today.
Pleasure.
And Alex, too. So I wonder what you think about today's discussion topic. If you've got any thoughts you'd like to send in, you are, of course, welcome to email me as normal. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the place to send your thoughts via email. You can also, of course, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at UnbelievableJB or Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. I regularly post updates there, both on Twitter and Facebook, so if you follow that way, you'll hear more about the show and some of the other articles that might be of interest to you. All of those links, the ways to get in touch and more available from today's show. If you go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, you'll find the latest show and be able to comment on it there as well. So look forward to what we have to hear from our guests today, Alex Gabriel and Richard Park. Can we build a godless, flourishing society?
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
It was you who suggested this title, Rick, but maybe Alex has some questions initially that he'd like to ask about this subject.
I mean, this is very much the kind of thing that you and I used to talk about over your pint and my non-pint, or pint or something else. I'm just wondering, I'm interested partly by the syntax of this question, but just tell me where you're coming from with this.
Yeah, so the thought here is, it seems to be that if we look past to the past few decades in the area of sort of secularization theory or what have you, there's been a lot of sort of taking God out of the public sphere, if you will. And I guess the question I'm thinking about there kind of juxtaposes that reality or that proposed reality alongside the fact that religion is, as one sociologist put it, as furiously alive as ever, right, in the 21st century. So what do we do with this idea that religion is a real factor in the public sphere, and how do we properly locate it without doing this kind of full-on repression or suppression of religion to what I would say is our own detriment? And so in other words, how do we properly locate faith, as it were, in the public sphere? And I have a couple of things we can kind of center our discussion around, if you like. We can obviously veer from there, but there are a couple, maybe three sort of, maybe we can call them kind of key ingredients to what might make up a flourishing society. And maybe we can talk about these ideas as to whether or not they would better fit in sort of, if you will, a naturalistic, atheistic worldview versus a Christian theistic worldview.
Okay, what about the premise then, as far as you're concerned, Alex?
Are you... I must admit that I tend to sort of read phrases like flourishing society and go, you know, there's a sort of benign and faint ring of Maoism in that phrase, I think. but, you know, it's interesting actually to look at the US now, because, you know, what strikes me personally is that, and you're very much in a position to confirm or dispute this, but when I look at popular culture in the US now, I see, you know, God is everywhere, but theology is kind of gone. You know, we're sort of on the way, and we're building a godless society already, or one is resulting from temples collapsing. But I look at, you know, Lady Gaga and Tim Cook, and to some extent Obama, although he's a bit different, but mentioning God is a sort of constant soundbite and everything. But it's not a God that really has very much actual belief attached to it. You know, God is a sort of a word that you add to your politics to make it sound more respectable.
People are more interested in being spiritual at some level.
Well, maybe, but it's not even that. It's sort of, you know, God loves you the way you are, so it's okay that you're a lesbian, etc. And it's, you know, one often gets the sense, or I do anyway, that God has been added into this sentence to make it feel a bit more comfortable. But if you ask the person speaking to say a bit more about God, you know, it's not
there,
obvious.
There wouldn't be much content there, necessarily.
Maybe not.
What do you think of that, Rich?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say that. So I was just kind of discussing this with my students as well. But you've got this move toward God talk, if you will, in the public sphere. And at the same time, we have our Miley Cyruses and other things like this that make you think of godlessness in practice.
Oh, but she, so, I'm sorry to interrupt, but her whole thing is only God can judge us. So, you know, it's okay that
so you're back to God talk. Sure, in a very different way. But even so, to your point, you look at the various movies that have come out recently, there's a lot of things that are very religious on film and so on and so forth. But I suppose you're right. I think I like your point about the distinction with respect to theology, right? So the question I have is, if we look at some things that we particularly prize in public life, things like freedom and human dignity and discussions around these topics of human rights and this sort of thing. So theologically, it seems that the Christian worldview would have something by way of really kind of grounding these things in some larger metaphysic, if you will, some, you know, larger picture of reality. And whether that can happen on a purely naturalistic worldview is one that I'm not so sure of. Now, I certainly appreciate how Alex really kind of you sort of distance yourself from some of the scientistic, materialistic sort of atheism that Dawkins and co tend toward. Mm-hmm. I guess the question is, if we're going to provide a robust sort of theoretical framing for the issues like or topics like human dignity, freedom, and maybe even sort of meaning of life and meaning of our labors, those were the things that I would want to sort of say. Yeah,
I'd even be interested in finding out in the first place, Alex. Do you want to build a godless, mm-hmm. flourishing society? I mean. Are you an anarchist? You know, maybe you're
something
not that interested.
Like that.
Maybe you're not that interested in flourishing societies or whether they be godless
more,
or not. I don't know.
I think, without deviating too much, it's always interesting seeing what people think is a flourishing society, because it rarely flourishes for everybody, you know, to the same extent. Go back a couple of years, look at the Diamond Jubilee, the Olympics, all of that. You know, a nation together. Well, actually, people were being cleared out of the East End and arrested before that happened. So... Mm-hmm.
Sure.
But digression. I think here's one of the things I would say about the specific question of, can we have a godless flourishing society? It seems to, presuppose the thing which is the instinct of religious conservatives, which is that religion dramatically... frames everything as far as social interaction and is kind of the architecture of society. And if we lose religion, then we'll have no framework around which to organise ourselves. Actually, the reality is that religion and individual religions are contained by societies, and they are shaped by things like nationality and historical period and ethnicity and social movement. You can look at religious beliefs across of all of those things. You can even look at Christianity in different parts of the US, and it's very obvious that... religion is something within society. It's not something that wraps around and determines the shape of it. Mm. So I think, I'm inclined not to say, actually, that if, we all woke up atheists tomorrow, we would sort of have no skeleton on which to put societal flesh. I think we would have holes in our existing society that we would fill or not fill.
Would we, if we did all wake up as atheists tomorrow... Mm. Would we have a better society? We were just crossing your fingers there, Alex, but for the benefit of those listening. But say that happened, would you anticipate that we would immediately begin to see a better society because it's atheistic?
You can perhaps tell. I tend not to make too much investment in words like, better and right and wrong and all of that. I think I would certainly prefer it. I would prefer a world... And I do think that if we woke up and God was suddenly not there, the world would begin to look very different. The shape of sub-Saharan Africa would look very different. The shape of, genital cutting in infants and all of that. Even to steer clear of the whole discussion of sort of terrorism and all of that kind of thing. Mm. And I am happy to think of that as a world to work toward, although it's certainly not the case that... you get rid of God and everything is fixed.
Sure.
And the current atheist movement does tend to show that
simplify
at the worst of times.
It. Yeah. Okay, let's throw the ball back to you, Rich. What would your response be?
I think there are definitely things that we need as religious communities to confess and admit, things that you just alluded to there, Alex. I think that we have, at the same token, we have to appreciate all the good that has come from religion, right?
Sure.
So, you and I think would both disagree with the idea that religion poisons everything. Everything from humanitarian organizations and hospitals to the universities that we studied in and so forth were kind of the fruits of a lot of really very specifically Christian as well as Muslim kind of worldview thinking that's kind of hit the ground. So that's probably the first thing I want to say. But more importantly, can we build a godless flourishing society? I think in some sense, we were chatting about this earlier, Justin, but I think yes, in a sense, right? Because if we look even to other major civilizations, whether it's the Greeks or the Romans or maybe even the Babylonian Empire, there are certainly amazing civilizational renaissance that took place in these, so to speak, godless, non-Christian at least, societies. I mean, they had their Greek pantheon of gods and so on and so forth too. But so, yeah, you're right. I think there, I mean, a Christian, a Muslim, a Hindu, an atheist, what have you, could help grandmother cross the street, as it were, and, you know, dig wells in developing countries and start an NGO. So there can be flourishing, I think. There can be flourishing even in a godless society. But would that flourishing be grounded in anything theoretical, anything deeper than just it just so happens to flourish?
Well,
right.
And you've already said that you prefer to use the word prefer to better, bad, which suggests to me you're unwilling to talk about objective values and the idea of there being a sort of specific goal that we should be aiming for, in a sense.
That's
in
pretty,
society.
I mean, yeah, now, of course, there are going to be sort of practical things which broadly people tend to prefer, and it's useful to have words like, you know, that would be a better situation as far as, you know, pragmatic conversations. But, yeah, I am...
a relativist, in that sense. Is that fair?
I was going to go with postmodern by leanings. But you know, I think fundamentally that a lot of things about the societies we live in just don't have roots in the way that you're talking about. I think, you know, for example, gender is not something that I see as, you know, stemming naturally from any sort of, you know, obvious basis empirically. And when you talk about the idea, would this sort of flourishing society where grandmothers are helped across the road have any kind of, you know, would there be a basis in that was concrete? Well, no, there wouldn't, but I'm not sure there would be in any society. I mean, from my point of view, the values that, you know, you connect that with are ones that are based on a faith that is baseless. You know, even if I were to accept that, you know, the tenets of religion naturally and logically give way to particular kinds of behaviour, which I don't particularly.
That still,
you
know, doesn't make religion
I still don't
true.
Believe sure. in the sure. religion, so...
Sure. That's I think that's a fair point. I wouldn't want to say that, you know, because we believe in things like human dignity matters or whatever, therefore God exists, right? But I would want to say that things like human dignity and human freedom and the meaning of our lives, this sort of language and the concepts attending sort of fit better, if you will, or make more sense within a worldview that has a personal being who's divine, who has a moral will, and so on and so forth, as opposed to, I mean, this is going far back, I realize, but it's still within our tradition of Oxford, but Bertrand Russell talking about the sort of accidental collocation of atoms is what our lives consist in. And so that's where I'd want to say there seems to be a more at-homeness when we talk about these sort of things and what makes up for a flourishing society than in the case of naturalism. But if I can I just go back just half a minute to, yeah, I didn't notice the term, so thanks for pointing it out, Justin, but the idea of, I guess, the preference idea there that Alex was suggesting. I don't know if you would humor me in a little anecdote that actually took place a couple years ago in Oxford.
Does it involve Alex?
No, well, it involves his view that I think he's suggesting.
I just wanted to make sure you weren't going to divulge some terrible student outing Alex wouldn't want broadcast.
He got drunk. I was sarcastic about it.
Go ahead, Rich.
So believe it or not, we're actually in a little seminar room with one of the professors at Christ Church, and Professor Peter Singer of Princeton came along and we had a chance to meet with him and chat with him about ethics and atheists and Christian ethics. And you know, knowing his view of what essentially amounts to a preference utilitarianism, where, you know, folks who, so long as they have their preferences, as long as it's not impeding other people's preferences, if we maximize those preferences, we essentially have a flourishing ethical world. That's a very simplistic rendition of it, but more or less. And so I actually on the kind of on the spot just thought of a possible counterexample to that, and I asked him. I said, Professor Singer, with all due respect, and I really do respect a lot of your other views, in this particular case, if let's just suppose we had a world in which quite literally half the world were masochists, right? People who take pleasure from having pain inflicted upon them. And the other half of the world's population were sadists, people who enjoy inflicting pain. Everyone's receiving their preference. Would we consider this a flourishing ethical world? Now, before I can maybe share his response back, Alex, I guess my question to you would be similar in the same lines. I mean, if we're talking about preferences and that one person does help grandma cross the street because of, you know, the worldview that they hold, but the other person doesn't, and it doesn't really, you know, everyone's choice is just a certain sense, you know, so long as it doesn't harm others, it can just be done. How would you
Is the sadomasochistic world okay, as far as you're concerned?
It doesn't sound too bad. I mean, certainly, you know, I hear a lot of atheists reeling off the do unto others thing. Well, you know, it's often not really a good idea to treat other people in the way that you would like to be treated. They may feel differently. But, gosh, I mean, there's a lot to respond to there. I would want to come back to a couple of things I was saying earlier. I mean, I think that, you know, the reality is that both religious narratives about why you should help somebody across the street and secular ones are really just vocabulary that is there because it helps express a particular desire to do something. And I think both of those things are subject to social influences. I was talking about the fact that, you know, religions are very much things which exist within societies and are determined by them. And, you know, the idea that religion is the thing which wraps around the world and provides, you know, one direction for the society to go in and everything else there needs to hew to it is kind of a totalitarian one, and it doesn't really work. You know, you can look at places like, for example, Saudi Arabia, where probably the most authoritarian religious people in the world. But actually, even there, you know, the religious order is significantly less influential than it would like to be. So it's fairly unreliable trying to look to religion for...
But is it any more reliable to look to your preferences, I suppose, is what Alex asks. Because, you know, that would mean that the world in which half the world were sadists, half the world were masochists, is the best kind of world we could hope for. Most people, I think, and I'll be interested to come back to you, Rich, as to what Professor Singer said, but most people would think, hang on, that doesn't sound, even if that were the case.
I didn't think that at all. I was expecting some sort of, you know, horrifically overblown example, and then I heard that and thought, oh, well, you know, consensual S&M exists, and it's, you know, pretty good, you know, if you're into that. But I think... You know, in the same way that I don't particularly believe that there's a sort of material basis for, you know, discussions like that, there isn't really a material necessity to talk about Pluto as A, a planet, or B, not a planet. But that doesn't mean to say that the discussion is arbitrary. You can still find more and less useful things to call it. And similarly, I think both religious and other language about the way we should behave to other people are actually there because they help shape discussions about the kind of relationships we want to form, and they help, you know, express the ways we relate to each other.
We're going to have to take a quick break, and we will come back to find out what Professor Singer said to you, Rich, in a moment's time. So just bear with us. We're talking about, can we build a godless, flourishing society today on Unbelievable? I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the programme that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. My guest today, atheist Alex Gabriel, Christian guest Richard Park. We'll be back in a moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
We talk affairs of the heart in the latest edition, following the hacking of Ashley Madison, the website dedicated to infidelity. Also, A Life Less Ordinary. Rachel and Andrew Wilson share their experience parenting children with special needs and how to cope spiritually with the life you never expected. Plus, apps to get you reading scripture again, Bible scholar Tom Wright, comedian Paul Carenza, and much more.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's show. I'm Justin Briley, and on Unbelievable, we're asking, can we build a godless, flourishing society? Don't forget, if you want to get in touch about anything you hear on today's programme, I'd love to hear from you as well. You can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find the links and other ways to get in touch as well from our website. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there to the podcast if you'd like to download the programme, get it straight onto your iPhone or your tablet or whatever. You can also, of course, find videos, articles, resources and much more there too. You can even comment underneath the latest edition of the programme. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. And we'll be hearing some of your thoughts in regard to recent shows towards the end of today's programme. Today, though, we're discussing, can we build a godless, flourishing society? My guests are Alex Gabriel and Richard Park. Alex is an atheist. He runs the freethought blog Godlessness in Theory. Raised in a church going home, he left his faith as a teenager, now calls himself an apostate, and he's been debating today on the programme with an old university friend, Richard Park, Rich to most people, part of the team at apologetics.com, joining us by Skype for today's discussion. And as I said, we don't have the beer that maybe you discussed over, though not in Alex's case, as we've heard. But we do have an interesting conversation going on, and I had to cut things off as we were going to hear what Peter Singer said to you, Rich, when you put this hypothetical situation of a flourishing world where, on his definition, it's flourishing because one group enjoys inflicting pain on another group who enjoy receiving the pain, which, you know, a lot of people might think there's something wrong about that situation. Maybe not. Depends. But anyway, what did the professor say to you, Rich?
Right. So so much like yourself, Alex, he actually did say that he would be sort of, he would have to conclude that this is a flourishing world. And so in that instance, as much as in the instances where, so for example, he's also okay with infanticide, because the difference between abortion and infanticide is merely location, whether inside the womb or outside. And so there's this rather chilling sort of consistency that Professor Singer holds on his views about these very deep moral issues. And so I guess I'd want to say that, you know, Alex, I appreciate, again, your consistency on your view of this. And you're saying, look, if there are people who prefer this sort of thing, and it just so happens that half the world is masochist and other half is sadist, then so be it. That's what we would call a, you know, everyone's getting their preference and utilities matched and so forth. I suppose I just wanted to say that, yes, to a degree, I think kind of falling McIntyre, like, who, you know, which flourishing, whose society. But surely our deep moral intuitions call us to make claims and pull us in directions that make us want to say, wait a second, that these things are just, this is not what's flourishing, right? And we understand human dignity to be an important universal truth, despite what other people might say about it. So, that's where I'm just having a little bit of trouble saying, like, if that's the godless flourishing society we're, you know, seeking to agree to or build.
Well, I'm not sure it is. I'm not sure that when we have the great atheist waking up mourning, half of the world will be masochists. But I have to say, I mean, I am interested because, you know, a world in which the majority of pain that was inflicted was consensual and on request sounds pretty good to me. My view is that all of the language that we create around things like morality and ethics and the way that we behave to each other is functional, and it's there to kind of, in the same way that we might decide whether or not to name Pluto a planet, what do we call this? And, you know, we are using the words in the discussion to help each other work out how we feel about
it. I guess what I'm coming to in this, and I don't know if this is the thought that you're trying to draw out here, Rich, is that equally, say, compared to the sadomasochistic society, a society in which everyone, you know, is hooked up to some endorphin machine and is simply having a wonderful time out of their head, that might maximise, in the sense, the pleasure that everyone's getting. But is that a flourishing society? Is it? Because to me, I guess my view of what flourishing means, you're flourishing in arts, academic, in the things that you're doing creatively. And it's not simply about getting the preferences you want, it, you know, the most amount of pleasure in that sense.
Right. And that of course, kind of harkens back to Robert Nozick's, you know, experience machine, right? So we're just getting all these impulses of pleasure, but it's just in the head, as it were. Wouldn't that be different from a flourishing society where in which we're actually living out experiences that some of which bring pleasure and some of which don't? But wouldn't we prefer that real world as opposed to the experience machine world?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I mean, first of all, having language that sort of allows you to say, I would subjectively prefer this is the kind of world I would like to live in, that does not give way to pure hedonism. You know, preferences and just, you know, undiluted pleasure are different things. But we have concepts like these because they enable dialogue and they're useful. But actually, I think ideas like preferences and consent and this is what would be best for me personally, let me listen to you, are actually much better at enabling those discussions than my invisible friend who is always right says this, so you should do that. And actually what you get when you structure social relations along religious lines and along the idea that here is a sort of hallowed idea that you have to hew to is relationships that tend to be quite dysfunctional. Many of the people actually in the world who behave, you know, either sadistically or destructively or in other ways and produce the kinds of pain that you're describing and the kinds of degradation and all of that are in fact people who claim that, you know, they have a sort of hallowed religious ideal of how the world should be and what is the most dignified, you know, holy way. So I think, a secular framework is often much less ambitious, but it's also much more reliable.
Right. Yeah. So I definitely agree that connected to your earlier point about how society in many ways sort of impacts on religion and shapes it as opposed to the other way around. I mean, I certainly think it's both ways, right? So, you know, when the famous 20th century Christian theologian Karl Barth was talking about the lordship of Christ, I mean, he was obviously speaking and writing from a context in which there was another supposed lord over Germany, right? Adolf Hitler. So there was this way in which his very context and the society he was in even shapes his very theology. And so there are numerous examples we can point to. And so I agree with that. I think it's also the other way, right? That religious ideas and ideals actually do impact society and come up in the form of things like hospitals and right. So, the point I'm trying to drive at is that if we want to, again, kind of, we can talk about these key ingredients that I've kind of thought through here, but or others, but. You know, these ideas of human dignity, all of which even I think it's the Amsterdam Humanist Manifesto recently put out about the importance of human dignity and so forth. And so this talk about human dignity or freedom, whether it's religious freedom or otherwise, just political freedom more generally, or even literally the meaning of life, right? So there I'm thinking of kind of our cultural life, our political life, and then our work life, the economics of society. These sort of themes and realities, not just labels, but realities, seem to fit home, you know, kind of have much more comfortably at home in a world in which there is a God who bestows dignity upon all human persons, that freedom matters because we are actually aiming at what a flourishing human life looks like. And to the extent that we're free to flourish, we have the right kind of society, and to the extent that we're not, we don't. And again, going back to meaning of life and the meaning of our labors, I think it was Sartre drawing on Dostoevsky, but he was saying, you know, if God does not exist, everything is permitted. And so this permission to do whatever we will with our life, and I'll have my life projects, and so long as they don't impede upon yours, we can just kind of agree to have different life projects. Mm. But that really kind of ends up in what one sociologist referred to as unfreedom, right? And this is, by the way, a secular sociologist, Sigmund Bauman, but he was talking about in his book In Search of Politics, kind of rightly named, he was saying this is really an unfreedom because there is no sense in which true community exists. And I think we've talked about this, Alex, too, in our smaller context there at the Open Forum in Oxford, but I think you agreed that there's a sense in which, you know, something like religion does provide a natural home for community, whereas, you know, atheist temples, you know, sprung up but quickly dissipated because it's not the thing that naturally fits within an atheist worldview to have deep community. And so
I'm sorry. I have to interrupt you. That sounds like a pretty daring paraphrase several years after the fact, I suspect.
Perhaps
I can't quite grant you permission to quote me on that. You know, I see why you say it feels like You know, it feels more natural because it is. It's an easier fit to say that you are correct in how you want to live if you believe that there's an ultimate, you know, universal law that is behind you. But, you know, for one thing, I just don't think that's a claim that is justified, or hasn't been at least. And also, you know, I'm actually, I think we should be pretty suspicious of the instinct to have, you know, the, you know, groundless rule that tells you you are right about your intuitions. Because it's not the case. I'm not arguing for, you know, a world in which we do whatever we want as long as it doesn't impact other people and we therefore avoid community. No, you can't have principles you live by without imposing them on other people. That's what ethics is for. It's about how you have relationships and how you relate to people. The point is, I'm actually much more comfortable, and yes, I prefer, to live in a world where I have to say, you know, I really don't know, ultimately. You know, I have intuitions, I have preferences, and I have ways that make me more comfortable to live, but, you know, I really should try and listen to people more, and I really should be a bit less certain, because what we see with the history of religion is not, you know, this sort of wonderful, faultless commitment to human rights. It's the fact that too much certainty leads to not paying attention to the people around you, and it leads to, you know, a discussion which lacks any vocabulary that lets people without quite so much power be able to talk about the way they experience the world.
I was looking up some quotes before we came into the studio. Now, you may not be a fan of Richard Dawkins. Are you a fan of Christopher Hitchens, Alex?
To an extent.
He said,
wouldn't idolise any of them.
He said, human decency is not derived from religion, it precedes it. I mean, what Alex is saying is you do need a kind of metaphysical foundation for the
I think
the,
you mean
values.
That's what Rich is saying.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, Rich is saying, I should say. Yeah. Christopher Hitchens wasn't.
But why don't we just attribute any quote we want to Alex instead of start doing that?
You may as well. Twitter does it already.
Okay. What Rich is saying is you do need this sort of metaphysical foundation for the things that most people do agree on are the goods we need for flourishing society and so on. Christopher Hitchens obviously didn't believe you needed, though, that. He somehow believes it's innate, somehow kind of there. Human decency is not derived from religion, it precedes it. Do you agree with that? Do you think, like, we will inevitably kind of agree on those things and we therefore don't need God to be able to build a flourishing society because it's somehow innate to us?
Well, it certainly does. You know, you can perhaps tell that I'm pretty conservative about the views I want to commit to, but it certainly does seem to be the case that ethical epistemologies from many different starting points do seem to converge around certain things not being preferable. Almost as if to suggest that we're coming up with ethical philosophies to justify our pre-existing instincts. Now, it's certainly true that, you know, the societies we create mediate the way we want to live, just as they mediate religion. But I'm inclined to say, I wouldn't quite use the words that Hitchens uses, but it's certainly true that society precedes religion, and religions are shaped by both their time and place and all of that stuff.
What do you make of that yourself, Rich? Both that statement from Hitchens and also what Alex said previous to that, which is that, well, religion doesn't have the best track record anyway at the things that you're saying you need it for in order to build a flourishing society.
Yeah. So I would certainly agree with Alex. The Catholic Church, for example, didn't come around to upholding the idea of equal human rights or even religious freedom until very late in its history, namely within the past about 100 years. And Vatican II was when it finally actually gave a real full articulation of it, which was only about half a century ago. Which is quite unfortunate, right? And so I certainly agree with you on that. As for, you know, I guess Hitchens' quote there, I mean, I guess the question I would want to ask is, suppose it didn't precede it, right? Suppose there were no sense of intrinsic human worth or human rights, universal human rights, that supposedly preceded religion. Then what? All right, so that would be the concern that I would have is it just, I mean, I don't know the context of that quote, but it sounds like he's saying it happened to precede it, but if it didn't happen to precede it, would we be okay with a world in which there were no sense of equal human, universal human rights? I mean, Alex, you're rightly concerned about the track record of certain religious communities and the idea of equality.
Well, all religious communities, really. I mean, you know, don't undersell me.
okay, perhaps, but see that to me kind of this. I feel like that points to this intuition that equal human rights is of value, is of ethical value, deep ethical value. And so, I guess I'd want to say, I mean, where does that moral intuition of yours derive from?
You can use that terminology if you want, if it makes you more comfortable. But personally, you know, if we're gonna end up at a point where all logic becomes slightly circular and we have to regress to somewhere, I'm much more comfortable saying, well, compassion just feels better to me than going, well, I think there's a God and we should do what he says because that feels rather less kind of a safe thing to commit to.
So I mean, this sounds like a sort of emotivism, right? Where So, but I mean, would you, so if someone were to say, look, I torturing this person for information or just for fun feels better to me than not, would we count that as flourishing or whatever language you want to use? I mean, would we count that as...
Wouldn't feel like it to me, but I also think...
But if it felt like that for somebody else, you'd say that's a constituent part of a flourishing society. We'll allow it to be...
Well, no. I mean, you know, I don't think that because, you know, I don't believe that there are kind of natural moral realities that everything else is arbitrary. But I also think, you know, most actual ethical disputes as they play out in the real world aren't about ought, they are about is. You know, the way that you encourage somebody to change their mind most of the time is by saying, well, here are aspects of my situation that you haven't considered. And actually, if you meet somebody who just wants to talk to you for fun, you're probably not going to get very far trying to explain why they should have an abstract moral value that is different from what they have. You know, you're much better off saying, you know, I have children and all of those things, and trying to appeal to some pre-existing instinct. You know, philosophical debate is unlikely to change the minds of people like that, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, so I actually had a chance, Justin, as well, to look up a couple of quotes, you know, well, some that I've actually kind of read through. But there's a couple. So Jürgen Habermas, right, is kind of a leading European social political theorist. And this is a pretty famous quote now, but he said something, I'm paraphrasing, but nearly verbatim. He said, the ideas of freedom, human rights, and democracy are the heritage of a Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love. Everything else is just idle postmodern talk. And this is writing as a naturalist, a secularist, and also the nihilist philosopher Gianni Vattimo said that equality will always be a metaphysical thesis because of its claim to capture a human essence given once for all. And as a nihilist, being consistent, Vattimo actually said that's why we have to reject equality. And so I guess you're right. This is quite theoretical. But I mean, that the theory does play into our practice and vice versa. But just focusing on the theory for now, I mean, I don't know. My thought would be, what would you say to someone like Vattimo or Habermas who says, look, actually, equality is better, is more comfortably at home in a metaphysical, or in Habermas's case, a Judeo-Christian ethic. And for that reason, well, at least Vattimo says, therefore, we have to give it up. I mean, this just goes back to the whole conversation of the existentialist, right, who said, look, it's existence that precedes essence. We can talk about essence later. There's no real thingness to a human person. We just exist, and we kind of therefore make up our plan. We take the bravado to make up our own life plans and projects, given that we exist. Whereas, you know, going all the way back to Aristotle, there was a sense where, wait a second, essence seems to precede the existence of a thing. There's a way in which a tree will always be a tree, and a dog, and a human are human. And because, given that aim, that teleology, the purposiveness of our lives, I think we can frame that discussion more comfortably at home in a sort of a Christian, or at least a theistic worldview, as opposed to, talking about things like equality and purposiveness of human life and all that within either an anarchist kind of society, or again, naturalistic view of human life?
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, you're unlikely to catch me talking about equality anytime soon, because that's not my politics. But
why do you say that? I must just tease that out.
You know, that's a whole other podcast.
Okay, maybe it is. But is there? I don't know. Are you saying that as a fundamental value, human value?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that as a particular activist slogan, equality has become something
fair enough. But I mean, can you accept? Do you have a sort of a fundamental commitment to the inherent dignity of humans, or something like that? Do you subscribe to, you know, the sorts of things that the Amsterdam Declaration on Humanism,
you know,
declared?
I would much rather the people who wrote that were in charge of the world. Well, if somebody has to be in charge of the world, I'd rather it were people like that. And I, you know, I share the instincts, those sorts of ideas.
But you don't, you label them instincts rather than an actual value.
Yeah, because I don't think expressing those sorts of positions as truth claims is particularly, you know, either accurate or useful. Actually,
they're helpful fictions.
Well, you know, is it a fiction that Pluto is a planet? Well, it's
depends
not. It's
definition.
Not, you know, a lie. It's a, you know, how do you choose to, you know, how do you choose to represent that thing in the way you think about it, and what concepts do you use to imagine it, and how do you imagine it in a more useful way? What I would say to Habermas in particular, since you ask, is, you know, it's always a slightly fraught term, Judeo-Christian history. Because most of Judeo-Christian history since Christianity has existed has been Christians not being very nice to Jews. So, you know, the whole sort of, you know, the idea that human rights as an idea stems from that isn't really borne out by history. Also, you know, I have to say, if we're going to talk about, you know, the original sort of, you know, the things that are in the Bible saying love thy neighbour and all of that kind of stuff as universal values, then you have to acknowledge that there are other ways of arriving at them.
Yeah, Alex, I think, again, I certainly agree with you, and anyone who's studied history extensively, or even, you know, rather superficially, ought to agree with you on that point about how Christians have treated Jews and how Jews and Christians have failed to live up to what they profess. And so that's certainly bad faith all over the place, right? But that doesn't take away from, I guess, those who more properly exhibit what the Christian ethic of love or the Judaic ethic of justice is supposed to be, nor more importantly what that ethic is, right? And so I think there are always, in a sense, people charge Christians of hypocrisy. My view is that actually Christians will always be hypocritical to an extent on this side of eternity, as it were. And that's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I think you get what I'm trying to say there.
Yeah, I mean, there are hypocrites in every tradition. Atheism is certainly not immune to that.
And I mean, call it acrasia, as Aristotle did, or the weakness of the will, or just the fact that we're fallen human persons. I mean, that can always be the case.
Sorry, can I come in here? Do you mind if I...
Oh, please, sure.
So I think it was interesting you were saying, you know, it's more comfortable using the language of teleology to talk about the structure of societies. And yeah, certainly it is more comfortable because it provides more certainty. But I think the certainty is false, and I think certainty is something to be a bit suspicious of when it comes to the sort of world that we want to live in.
Is that something you're certain of?
Yes. No, I am certainly with the existentialists on that point. But, you know, I think
Alex, look, I totally agree with you, right? So coming from the States over to England... this is I'm not betraying my people here, but there was a sense in which I looked back and I thought, wow, I tended, along with a lot of my friends and colleagues around me, to speak with a lot of certainty. And so forgive me if I've done that, because when I was in England, I realized, my goodness, we tend to have this full assurance of things that sometimes isn't warranted, and I fully grant that. And, you know, it may be unfortunate that I've probably, maybe in some ways, I come off that way or slip back into some of my patterns of speaking. On the other hand, right, so I went to an undergraduate college where skepticism was sort of the reigning philosophy. Uh-huh. And if you weren't skeptical, you know, you weren't smart. Like, you couldn't know anything. Mm-hmm. And that was your sign of intelligence, right? Yeah. Oddly. And so I was just there actually a couple of weeks ago visiting, doing some speaking. And so I try to make the point that actually, yes, let's always be open-minded. Let's be, let's hold beliefs in a way that is open to correction. Yet, as one former professor of mine put it, you know, you can be so open-minded that our brains fall out, right? So there's got to be a sense in some, at some point, we've got to make a claim and a stake in our claims about what a flourishing society consists in. And when we talk about things as we are about, you know, intrinsic human dignity and universal human rights and this sort of thing, I'd want to say that let's at least begin with some theory, and hopefully some of that will make its impact on the ground.
We're going to take a quick break.
Sorry.
We'll be into our final 5 or 10 minutes to start to wrap things up. It's been a really interesting conversation, though, so far. And even without beer, it's been flowing well. So thank you for listening. And do come back in just a moment's time. We're going to conclude today's episode of Unbelievable, the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. Welcome back to the final part of today's programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable. This is the show where Christians and non-Christians get together for dialogue and discussion every week. Don't forget that straight after today's programme, you can hear The Profile, and Paul Carenza is Dave Rose's guest today. Paul is a stand-up comedian, he's a Christian, and he's going to be talking to us about his life in comedy. He's got some really exciting projects on the go at the moment. In fact, if you watch the BBC, you may have seen the new series The Kennedys. He's one of the script writers for that. He's also a script writer for the TFI Friday programme. It's new reincarnation with Chris Evans on Channel 4. So worth listening to. Really fun guy. And also checking out the interview in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine. That's the November edition. You can see it for yourself online. We've got the article up on our website at premierchristianity.com with Paul Carenza. But you can ask for a free sample copy and read it in print. It's even better in print, I have to confess. PremierChristianity.com/freesample if you'd like to avail yourself of that. Coming up a little bit later, your feedback, as I mentioned earlier, a real bumper mailbag of feedback for the issue of intelligent design from a couple of weeks ago. That's really got you interested. And also last week's on suffering, two different views of suffering, what we call the warfare versus blueprint model. Some people objecting actually to the use of the pejorative term blueprint, and I'll read some of those responses a little bit later on as well. Next week on the programme, we're going to be looking at the subject, which we sort of covered in different ways, actually, over the last couple of months, on do scientific explanations explain away God? David Glass is developing some research in that area. He's a Christian, and he's responding to what he believes is a common atheist objection to God, and we'll be featuring an atheist guest, or possibly two, opposite him next week for that. So listen out for more details, same time next week. And if you've got anything you'd like to listen back to, something you heard, ways to get in touch, all of that stuff available, of course, from the Unbelievable website. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can listen back to today's programme there, add your thoughts as well, find the ways to get in touch. There's videos, articles, blogs, and much more besides. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Let's get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So as we conclude our conversation, can we build a godless, flourishing society? My guests today on the programme have been Alex Gabriel. You can look him up at the Freethought blog Godlessness in Theory. And we're going to also be concluding with Richard Park, who is part of the team at apologetics.com. Links to both of those guys and their associated websites from today's show page. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. So we've been talking lots of different ways. We've had thought experiments. We've had the practical issues. We've talked about whether we can have talk of fundamental human rights and so on if we're talking about an atheistic, godless society, whether we need that kind of metaphysical foundation in order to agree on what the things are that make for a good flourishing society and so on. Obviously, Rich's view is that you do need something like that, that the Judeo-Christian heritage that Western society is fundamentally built on it wasn't an accident that we, I guess, developed human equality and so on, things like that. Is it your view, Alex, that I don't know, we could have a good crack at it without any belief in God, at kind of developing that same thing. Would you be confident we would develop those sorts of
values? We are already in that place. I mean, we are at a point in history where, you know, religion, at least a lot of the time, across public and shared culture, is being shaped by pre-existing intuitions, just as it always has been. This is what I was saying at the start of the programme. You know, we're now, in the past 50 years, you've got LGBT-affirming churches. Well, you wouldn't have had those for 95% of, you know, prior Christian history. So, you know, I think the idea that there's a sort of natural result that comes from the genesis of a religion and it goes in a predictable direction is... well, it's frankly nonsense. I mean, nobody could have gone back in a time machine to the beginning of Christian history and predicted, I don't know, Mormonism, say. But to backtrack slightly to what Rich was saying, yeah, I think it's we need models for the way that we interact with other people, and we need to have language and ideas around that that make communication possible. But, you know, if it's not actually working, you know, if you've got a sort of... a model of ethics that provides apparent, you know, if you're willing to accept the idea of God, provides apparent absolute moral confidence, and yet the people who attempt to live by that fail to, then there's a problem there. I was reading in the lobby here before we started, featuring Christianity magazine about marriages breaking apart, where the essential, you know, issue was, it is fundamental to our religious belief that our marriages have to work, so why aren't they?
Mm.
Well, you know, I'm willing to accept the trade-off if having an approach to ethics like mine means that I don't, you know, have the sort of absolute confidence that somebody like Rich does, but I do have language and ideas that more accurately models how I actually feel, you know, and on which I can rely to, you know, structure my behaviour in ways that are, you know, I actually don't have a problem living the way that seems best to me.
Do you have any worries, Rich, about when Alex does claim his rightful place as president of the godless Earth?
I think we established I'm an anarchist here.
So, after his anarchist period, when he becomes president,
yes.
what do you make of this view that in the end, okay, he's not claiming to have all the answers, but as far as he can see, the best way of doing things is to kind of work it out as you go along, see what feels right. That way is a better approach than sort of a top-down certainty that is the worry that Alex has about organized religion particularly, I think.
Yeah, and again, and thanks, Justin and Alex. I appreciate that, right, that concern about this over-certainty, and I want to be careful of that, so I appreciate this friendship that we can continue to have this dialogue. Yeah, and the whole marriage thing, just real quick, I mean, it's really important because that's very unfortunate. And I want to own up to that. I want to own up to the fact that as Christians, we have done a really bad job. I mean, even in the States, among evangelicals at that, you have 50% of a divorce rate, which in some some statistics actually outnumber those of non-Christians. And so you're right. I think that article, I haven't read it, but it seems to be pointing at the right direction. I guess what I want to say, kind of in conclusion to some of this, is that even the fact that we have this, I mean, I think I saw Justin on one of your earlier episodes or a couple of weeks ago about something like can Christians and atheists stop fighting or something like that. I haven't had a chance to listen to that, but I would have thought that some, you know, friendship like the one Alex and I enjoy would be a counterexample to that, right? That we actually can stop fighting, that we actually are moving toward, hopefully, what is actually true, good, and beautiful.
To be honest, it sounds like Alex has more fights with his fellow atheists than
I can find time for all of you. Believe me.
But you know, even to have this sort of open discourse and to value that, to have something, again, back to human dignity and the meaning of life and freedom, and to value those things, as opposed to, say, as you pointed out, Justin, about kind of an emotivism of, well, if we want to value, if some people value sadism, masochism, torture, what have you, if we want to have these, if we want to just put in these terms, higher moral values and actually bring them into a society and try to sustain them, I do think that we need to have continued conversations like this. But But that just goes to the point of showing that we, both Alex and I, do appreciate this kind of open dialogue. We actually have values on things like human dignity, and we respect one another as persons fully, and our opinions. And so I guess I'd want to say these just kind of are signals to something larger, which is there's reason why these things matter to us. And so I would just want to say to Alex, maybe others who are listening, that that some of this seems to find a good home in a theistic worldview, and particularly a Christian theistic worldview. Though I'm open to saying, look, there are some things that I certainly don't have right, and I'm still trying to work things out.
Well, it's been great fun having you both on, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming in. Thank you for being on the line, Rich, as well. And all the best. As I say, links to both my guests and where you can find their blogs from today's website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Why not leave a comment as well underneath the latest edition of the program? Might even try to entice Rich and Alex to join in the conversation as well, if they have time. But it's been great having you both on. Thanks for coming back in, Alex.
Pleasure.
And when you are head of the Atheist Federation of the World, we'll look for...
They don't want me, I don't want them.
In any case, great to have you with me. And we'll be going to some of your feedback in just a moment's time.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Time to wrap up with some of your feedback, though there's so much of it, I've wanted to put a little bit of extra time aside, a bit more than usual for this. Apologies as well if you can hear a sort of faint rumbling in the background. For the past couple of weeks now, the offices next to us here at Premier Towers have been being redeveloped into a set of sort of swanky apartments, and it involves a lot of drilling. So the poor team here at Premier have been having to sit through hours of drilling at high volume near their desks. But in any case, if that's what you can hear, that's the explanation. Let's go to some of your feedback. And again, if you want to get in touch with the programme today, you can do that by emailing unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Why not send me a tweet or a Facebook message as well? facebook.com/unbelievablejb if you want to follow the Facebook page. Twitter is @unbelievablejb if you want to follow me on Twitter. Got this from Joey in Denver, Colorado. He says, I've been listening through new and old episodes regularly over the last 6 months. I really appreciate what you do. Feel your show is a blessing to Christians and non-Christians alike. I recently wanted to study up on Mormonism and found the episodes I discovered on the Unbelievable resource wonderful. Thank you very much. I do have one question. I used to be an apologist wholeheartedly when I was in my late teens and 20s, though I didn't know what I'd call myself at the time. I'd primarily focus on demonstrating the invalidity of macroevolution. Now that I'm in my 30s, I find myself caring far less in that area. I came to this stance via 2 points. If undeniable evidence of macroevolution were presented, my faith would not be shaken. If God wanted us to evolve from single-cell organisms over the course of billions of years, who am I to question him? And all of the evidence in the world could not be more powerful than an infinitely powerful God. This meant that all points were moot. You have a fossil that can be dated 2 billion years. I have a God who could create that instantly with all the evidence of its past. So the question is this: how do apologists remain entertained in holding such debates when they're backing up our infinitely powerful God who cannot ever be fully understood or refuted? Thanks for everything. While I don't argue these points much anymore, I do love the show. Thanks, Joey. I guess, you know, where you're coming from in that is simply you've gone on a journey where some aspects of apologetic debate are not as important to you as they used to be, obviously. Obviously, for those for whom they do still focus on, you know, undermining a macroevolutionary view of biology or whatever, that's presumably because they believe there's a good reason for doing that, that it does provide better rational grounds for believing in God. Perhaps they're seeking to undermine a sort of secular Darwinian sort of methodology that's going on in science. I guess everyone has their own reasons, don't they? And you've obviously felt that it's not a battle you're particularly interested in fighting anymore. Perhaps there are other more interesting areas of apologetics that have now taken over for you. But thanks for getting in touch anyway. Wanted to give a chance for Ed Atkinson, who was our guest coming up for 3 weeks ago now on the resurrection. And I read out in last week's show, maybe the show the week before even, some responses to that program. I wanted to give him a chance for his feedback as well on what people had said. He weighs in on Paul in Belfast. And Ed says, Paul in Belfast, just to remind you, Ed was our non-Christian guest, former Christian, and he was in debate with Christian apologist Tony Costa on the evidence for the resurrection. And Ed says, Paul in Belfast made an excellent point on the reason for why the resurrection from our earliest records is said to be on the third day. The responses I had ready for that issue were, firstly, it may have been influenced by scriptures taken to predict a third day, or, more plausibly, secondly, in view of my guess that a hallucination set off the whole chain of events, the hallucination could have been on the third day. And next, Paul rightly shows that the guard at the tomb is evidence that a hostile response to the resurrection was the disciples stole the body rather than there was no tomb or the tomb was never empty. I agree that the hostile response is very useful evidence, but we cannot confidently place that hostile response any earlier than the time of Matthew's writing, near or any nearer than the location of the gospel. Both are thought to be well distant from the events in Jerusalem in AD 30. And you go on to say Paul's point that the silliness within the details of the guard's story is evidence for its veracity is to me a matter of taste. Matthew seems especially prone to including implausible material unique to his gospel. And finally, about Paul's contributions, you say, on Joseph of Arimathea, Paul picks up that I just gave my assessment of him as I went down my list of issues. Paul is correct. I gave no backing arguments as we never got back to the issue. This is an important area and there's so much to say. I'd love to hear a whole show on Joseph of Arimathea and the burial traditions in the Gospels. And you also respond to Josh. You say it was lovely to hear from Josh from the London Discussion Group and congratulations for his prize. We're planning to hear him speak on the subject of his essay at another discussion group in Henley. Josh lists some problems with hallucination theory, which I'd agree with if it was the sole theory I had for the various appearances and the interpretations the disciples drew from them. My assessment is that one or two hallucinations set in train the events that led to the outcome we see in Paul and the Gospels, but those many other factors I listed near the end of the discussion with Tony were important as well. Well, on the subject of Ed's theory about did hallucinations, could they account for the resurrection appearances and so on, we had another email that I read out again last week or the week before, which was Stephen Pimkin, which was someone called Stephen, a US clinical psychologist, who sort of sent an email debunking the idea that it could have been hallucinations. And again, Ed responds to that as well, saying, to me, Stephen's most important claim is that hallucinations only occur in the mentally ill, especially schizophrenia. I'd like to hear more on this. I've assumed that they were grief hallucinations, i.e. experienced by bereaved people with normal mental health. There's plenty of material in the literature concerning grief hallucinations. For example, Michael Licona references this literature, though, of course, he explains why he considers they are not an adequate explanation. And indeed, I connected you with Stephen, who sent in that email, and you've been having a lively exchange with him as well over it. So no time to report all the ins and outs of that. But in any case, it's encouraged quite a lot of interesting discussion on that. Well, time to get to some other stuff. So specifically, last week's programme was on suffering. As I mentioned, Kurt Jaros and Ken Brownell were joining me in the studio. Kurt taking what's called a warfare view of suffering, and Brownell taking what we came to term just loosely a blueprint view, essentially a Calvinist view on suffering, that God intends and directs and sovereignly ordains all good and all evil in his divine purposes, whereas the warfare view sees that free will is going on and that God isn't in that sense directly responsible for evil. Rather, there's a cosmic battle going on both in the supernatural and in the physical world. So that was a really interesting debate. Got a lot of you interested in writing in. Apologies, I won't be able to read out that many of the responses here. But here's Matt Bristol on Facebook, who says, as an undogmatic deist, I'm surprised at how often the theological discussions on Unbelievable inspire me. The discussion about suffering and higher purpose got me thinking that there could be a benign force that would allow all the the evils of evolution because they're needed to develop higher life forms, likewise honouring human free choice. Such a force wouldn't interfere with bad human choices, since the failed experiment might be the only way to get us to believe what is true and convince us of the need for love. Thanks, Justin. Excellent guest and hosting. Keep up the great work. Well, that thought you had, Matt, is one that I have heard before as well, the idea that just for the process of creating a nervous system in higher primates and so on, you have to be able to feel pain and so on and all that sort of thing. That there are those who would say that was simply part of God's bigger purpose and reasoning, as it were. And so, in a sense, there is a purpose for why we experience pain. But Mark says, you really have the best show format going. Bravo for consistency over so long. And Mark's among a few people coming in support of the so-called warfare view that Kurt was defending on that show last week. So Mark says, I find the Calvinist position on suffering quite indefensible. It seems simple to me that foreknowledge does not at all have to involve divine engagement. It just means God knows the end from the beginning. The idea that God controls it all is a very inferior definition of sovereignty. His true sovereignty is that he can work in and around man's very genuine free will choices and still bring about his ultimate purposes. We also tend to forget that in Job, Satan has more power to control man's situation, but through his trial, Job receives a beautiful revelation of the one who will come to turn the tables and crush Satan's authority through the cross. I believe Calvinism has helped neuter and disarm the church rather than inspiring it to command in Jesus' name, your will be done, your kingdom come. If God's will is being done anyway, then why did God in Jesus tell us to keep praying this prayer? Why did Jesus get angry with Chorazin and Bethsaida for not repenting in the revelation of his presence and power? Was he just play acting? It's always wrong to find simplistic formulae for suffering, but I'm convinced the true biblical picture is we're in the army now and partnering with the Lord in bringing in his kingdom. Mark in California says, I thought Kurt did a pretty good job defending the war position. However, I think he missed the importance of prayer. Being raised Presbyterian, I would sometimes have discussions about predestination with my Southern Baptist friends. They could never quite understand how I could reconcile free will with predestination. Folks often think eternity is a long time. In my view, eternity is no time at all. God is completely out of time. Therefore, what happens today or 100 years from now is all the same to him. For him to know what happens across the span of time doesn't seem a mystery to me. He knows the consequences of the choices we make, but he will not force us to make the right choices. One thing I've come to believe is that our journey on earth is not for our personal pleasure. We live to learn things that serve us in eternity with the Lord. All of us die, so why the big fuss over when, except in the lives of the survivors? Will not eternity dwarf our current state? One of the most interesting insights from C.S. Lewis is that suffering is not a cumulative thing. There's only so much suffering in the world as there is in one's own life. No one experiences anyone's suffering but her own. The Bible teaches us overwhelmingly that God wants us to pray to accomplish his will. He is the ultimate gentleman. He will not interfere in our lives unless we ask him. When we do ask, he has promised to answer. If we do not ask, why do we blame him? Okay, thank you very much, Mark. And David, coming in on this as well, says, listen to the podcast, thought Kurt Jaros did a great job articulating the warfare and, dare I say, common sense view of evil and suffering. I have to say Ken Brownell failed to articulate a consistent Calvinist/Augustinian view of meticulous control. When asked about particular cases of evil, to be honest, Ken sounded more like an Arminian or warfare advocate. Not that I disagree when he drifted away from the blueprint view, as it is reprehensible to put evil and suffering as the result of God's direct causation, but he simply dodged the implications of his theology. You can't have it both ways. God cannot be rendering everything certain as he meticulously controls everything under their exaggerated view of what sovereignty means, and yet somehow when cancer comes, a rape occurs, or some other unquestionable evil takes place, God is off the hook. Okay, and David goes on at greater length than that, but unfortunately time is against us, and I want to get some of the other side in here as well. People who writing in from a more Calvinist perspective on that. Rich says, I want to commend you for your programme. That said, I found the most recent debate on suffering disappointing. I might have let the blueprint title go if you hadn't posted that in the very information on the podcast. Naming things is a way to control a debate, and calling a view a blueprint already gives credence to what amounts to a spurious misrepresentation. I might point out that you even kept referring to the notion of God's providence as being a Calvinistic view. It is not. It is more properly referred to as the orthodox view regarding providence. The Reformation was not a revolution, but a reformation, and there were many orthodox doctrines maintained. Read any orthodox statement of faith, and it will affirm God's providential care and control of all things. It's not Calvinistic to affirm that God's aseity, foreknowledge, and providence are systematically linked. Your guest ought to have noted that his is not a departure from Calvinism, but from an orthodox doctrine. It is part of the problem that I have with some of your guests whom you represent as Christian. You at least didn't cede the title Christian to the Mormon on your show who demanded it, but you regularly seem to have guests that claim that title but deny tenets of basic orthodoxy that the ecumenical creeds of the church have long recognized as outside the boundaries of orthodoxy. And you go on to say the cosmic warfare proponent gave a facile presentation of his view and made several false misrepresentations of the orthodox view of providence. He didn't even begin to deal with the overall dogmatic consequences of his own view. Anyway, again, apologies, I can't read the whole of the email out, but we get the point there, Rich, that you feel we need to not see this as a Calvinist thing. This is simply orthodox doctrine. Here's one from Mike in Toronto, Canada. There's no comfort in saying to a mother who's grieving over the murder of her child that God has a plan and there's a meaning to all events in life. Instead, one should say, God knew that your child was going to be murdered and he could have stopped it, and he has done for others in the past, but this time he didn't. Or, God didn't know your child was going to be murdered and he watched it happen and was powerless to prevent it. Now, please explain to me how these responses are superior pastoral comfort for the bereaved. To say that Job was mistaken when he said the Lord gives and takes away displays an ignorance of the writings of most of the Old Testament prophets. In Boyd's book on the subject, God at War, he glaringly ignores the prologue of Job, and this was also the case in this debate. It was God, the sovereign of the kingdom of heaven, who allowed, or decreed, if you will, that Satan would carry out the persecution of Job. I think the real problem here is a misunderstanding of God's sovereignty and decrees, and part of the blame for this misunderstanding, unfortunately, comes from Calvinists themselves. God's sovereignty and decree does not equate with hard determinism and meticulous control and the creation of a race of robots or puppets. Josh says, I've been enjoying these podcasts since my brother introduced them to me a few months ago. I find them well-guided, enjoy the spirit of open and frank discussion. Really good stuff. With respect to the recent program on warfare and blueprint views, I find that one of the challenges inherent to Christian theological debate is a Neoplatonic desire to come to an understanding of an idealized form of truth. Try saying that quickly. With respect to the different models discussed in the podcast, I'm happy to abide in a sense of tension between an active spiritual battle in which we are involved and a sovereign God who's already won the victory over death through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Through all the discussion, I didn't hear a model that accurately synthesized these two perspectives, both of which have merit. Instead, they appeared to describe separately two sides of godly wisdom. I likened it to the paradoxical way in which the physicists describe how light behaves as both a wave and a particle. Neither is false, but neither describes light holistically. After all, we encounter similar paradoxes in the divinity and humanity of Christ, the Trinity, free will, and many other parts of theology. Yes, I think that's a really interesting and valid point you're making there, Josh. Thanks for writing in. Lots more here. Unfortunately, no time to get to them. So we're going to have to leave it there for this week. Thank you for listening, and I hope you can come back again at the same time. Don't forget, if you want to send in your thoughts about today's show, then do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. On the way next, Dave speaks to stand-up comedian Paul Carenza on The Profile. But what's coming up next week? Let me tell you now. You're unbelievable. David Glass joins me. He's developing some research in the area responding to what he believes is a common atheist objection to God. Has scientific explanation done away with the need for God as an explanation? Well, he's going to be joining me with a couple of atheist guests. Hope you can join us too as we debate that important subject. See you then at the same time next week here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.